Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Thank you everybody for that very warm and generous welcome. I'm very pleased to be at Greenbelt. I've been hearing about it for a couple of years now, and I'm so happy to finally be here. And I've been here with my daughter for the last couple of hours, and this seems to be a really warm, generous, compassionate, courageous place. So I'm really happy to be here. Let me just say, though, that I am a bit nervous these days when I speak at any meetings, because if I can put it to you in an anecdote, I was speaking to a group of people in the United States, and I was talking about the moment of history that we're in right now can be described as a moment of global moral panic that has a couple of things that are driving it. I will just quote the four most important things to me, which are deepening inequality, the rise of oligarchic wealth, as the academics would say, the rise of authoritarian power. And by authoritarian power, we're meaning not just Trump and Bolsonaro, but it's Orban in Hungary, it's Modi in India, it's Duterte in Philippines, it's, you know, the list is long. In fact, I have it on good authority that all of them have a common WhatsApp list moderated by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, where they are swapping tactics about how to keep people's demands for justice down. So the third trend is growing xenophobia, and that xenophobia practice is going beyond single countries. For example, in the last, say, 6 to 9 months, I've been to 6 countries, and when I got there, people said to me, oh, did you know that Steve Bannon was just here a couple months ago? Steve Bannon, everybody knows him, the campaign manager of Donald Trump. The other campaign manager is in prison, Manafort. This one is running around spreading xenophobia around the world. And then the fourth challenge is that of existential threat of climate change. And let's be very clear, what the scientists told us in October last year should have all of us shivering in our boots and saying, we need to do whatever it takes to avert catastrophic climate change, when the scientists tell us last October that we have 12 years, of which 1 year is gone almost, 12 years to get emissions to peak and start coming down and to be reduced by almost half by 2030. And right now, we're on a track of not reducing emissions, but continuing to increase emissions. So anyway, I'm telling all of this and not dissimilar to the looks on your face, I was seeing the same looks in the face of this American audience who were like getting more and more depressed. Then when the Q&A time came, one woman put up her hand and said, Dr. Naidu, have you heard of Martin Luther King? And I said, yes, he inspired me and many other South Africans. Then she said, do you know what his most famous speech was called? Thinking it was a trick question, I answered it very tentatively. I said, I have a dream. And she shouted back at me. She said, yes, it was I have a dream. But when you speak, it sounds like you got a nightmare. Everything is collapsing. The forests are disappearing. The oceans are rising and so on. So in this story is my first challenge to us as we think about how do we shift power in the world. How do we find the capability to speak truth to power, not sanitize the deep crisis that humanity finds itself in, on the one hand, but also to do that in a way that doesn't depress, demotivate, and immobilize people. We have to somehow be able to tell the truth about where things are, but do it in a way that encourages people to actually stand up and resist, but not in a way that creates a sense that things are too late and things are so desperately bad, let's just give up. But let's be clear, when we talk about things being too late, and that is why the question of civil disobedience has to be firmly at the center of our conversations today. We are not 5 minutes to midnight in terms of averting catastrophic climate change. We are way beyond 5 minutes to midnight, and time is running out and the window of opportunity is small and it's closing fast. But now, as I see more of you also getting depressed, let me tell you, there's some good news. You probably heard people like me at some point say, save the planet, save the climate, save the environment. The good news I want to share with you is that the planet is absolutely fine. The planet does not need any saving. Because if we continue on the path that we are, what will happen? We warm up the planet to the point where we deplete our water resources, we deplete our soil, the climate gets hotter and hotter, we're not able to do agriculture. The end result will be we will be gone, the planet actually will still be here. And the good news is once we become extinct as a species, the forests will go back, the oceans will recover, and you know some of the animal species will return and so on. So don't worry about the planet. We have to understand the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change is nothing less and nothing more than protecting our children and their children's future. And when political and business leaders have abandoned our young people to the point where they govern in a way as if we don't have children and grandchildren coming after us, then we have to be looking at new ways of resistance and old ways of resistance that maybe we stopped using that need to actually be used more powerfully in the current moment that we find ourselves in. So I want to say, though, one of the challenges that we have right now is how we analyze how we got here and how we're going to change things. Now, one of the things, you know, when I was at Greenpeace, quite often I'll be speaking in places like the US, sometimes in Europe and so on, where one of the questions people should always ask is, how are we going to address climate change if people in Asia and Africa don't have fewer babies? Right, you know, population question. And I am somebody who believes that we must deal with the question of population. However, the best way you deal with population is not by talking about it, but by simply engaging in serious attempts to foster full gender equality. Gender equality delivers that result, and you can see that everywhere in the world. When women take control of their lives, their bodies, and so on, the question of population sizes actually shifts. So I today come to the conclusion that the biggest disease we face in the world is not influenza or any other disease, but is a disease that you could call affluenza. So affluenza I describe as a pathological illness where people have been led to believe that a good, decent life comes from more and more and more material acquisitions. And if we do not address that problem, we don't stand a chance to address the challenge of climate change. More than 10 years ago, WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, said that if we were to deliver the same lifestyle that folks in developed countries generally enjoy and the elites in developing countries generally enjoy, we need between 5 and 8 planets. Okay? Let me just say that again. If we were to say that the life, say, folks in the UK live, the consumption levels, and we say everybody in the world roughly can have the average of that, we'd need a minimum of 3 planets, but probably closer to 8 planets. And so we have to be thinking about fundamental systemic and structural change. So when, for example, the financial crisis happened, what we had in terms of response from our governments in 2008, it was all about system recovery, system protection, and system maintenance. But what that financial crisis should have taught us, as well as previous financial crisis should have taught us, that what we need right now is system innovation, system redesign, and system transformation. That's why when you see the kids marching with the climate strikes, you'll see one of the signs they carry is system change, not climate change. So to make that change, though, is going to be an Herculean task, a massive task that will take a kind of moral courage that we have not seen. And I want to turn to Martin Luther King to give us that motivation. Speaking in the mid-1960s, he said, and I quote him now, he said, "My friends, as I come to the end of my speech, I want to note that in the field of modern child psychology, there's a very dominant term called maladjusted. Now, all of us want to live a well-adjusted life and not suffer from schizophrenia or other mental illnesses. But my friends, I say to you, there are certain things in our world that are so immoral and unjust that good, decent people should refuse to be well adjusted to. Then he goes on to say, I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to racial discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to the mindless expenditure on military weapons when people don't have food to eat. And lastly, and importantly on the economy, he said, I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few when millions of God's children are smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in an affluent society. Unquote. So he was talking in the mid-60s. If it was relevant to the United States then, it's 1,000 times more relevant to the United States today as it is relevant to virtually every country around the world. So in a longer version of the speech, he says, I now call upon decent men and women around the world to come together to form a new international organization. The organization was never formed. To be known as the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Right? And bottom line is, far too many of us, including those of us like myself, who seek justice and have done so for a long time, have to question whether, in fact, we have adjusted to things that we absolutely should not have adjusted to. The immoral levels of inequality that exist between rich and poor. The immoral amounts of money that is spent on military expenditure, right? The fact that the only country in the world that used a nuclear weapon in Japan during the Second World War is the one which believes that they have the right to police the other countries that have nuclear weapons or are seeking to have nuclear weapons. When what we should be talking about, all countries should be scrapping nuclear weapons a long time ago. And instead, what we have is Russia and Trump and Putin. Do you know what love affair is going on between them and what conversations that they're having, because no other officials are in there, about what scary moment we are in now with the cancellation of that nuclear treaty. So, within this context, I want to suggest to you that if history teaches us anything, when humanity has faced a major injustice or a major challenge, those struggles only move forward when decent women and men said, enough is enough and no more. We prepare to put our lives on the line if necessary. We prepare to go to prison if necessary. So, in this moment, this is what we have to actually recognize is called upon us. And sadly, the only people in terms of a clear cohort of citizens that get it fully are who? Say it again. Children. Children, high school children, for the last 2 years have led this movement. They have been super creative. With a hashtag and a passion and a vision and knowledge, they have created one of the biggest global movements to be set up in the shortest space of time. And on the 20th of September, they've challenged all of us to join them in a global climate strike to bring a clear message to our political leaders that we will not tolerate the inaction and the collusion that we see between very many governments and the most powerful interests in the fossil fuel sector. Because let's be very clear, the reason change is not happening right now, when we have the technology, we have the know-how, we are seeing it happening, solar, wind, and other renewable energy prices are coming down, why do we struggle to make the change on energy, for example, which is a key factor? It's because the oil, coal, and gas companies that are making truckloads of money right now basically own many of our governments. They are determining what policies our governments make because they've paid for the elections, they've bought the elections, and so on. So within that context, what does civil disobedience offer us? And why is it so important? So, you know, the struggle for justice is not a popularity contest. However, I can guarantee you, those of you in this audience today who muster the moral courage to engage in acts of peaceful disobedience to push forward the struggle for justice right now, history will record you well, as it has done with many of the leaders before. Think about it. Martin Luther King, 41 times arrested. Today in Washington, D.C., there is a memorial to him that is as big as any president, and unlike most other presidents, is a national public holiday in his honor. So he was vilified and thrown in prison in the era when he stood up, but history judges him in a very positive way. Same with Rosa Parks, who refused to sit at the back of the bus. Same with Nelson Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison. He's the only person in the history of the humanity that every country in the world agreed that on his birthday, 18th of July, will be a day of international service for humanity and is commemorated. Mahatma Gandhi, the same. Vilified, thrown in prison both in South Africa and in India. Today, you know, there are memorials and so on. So don't worry about the vilification that might come from acts of civil disobedience. I mean, right now, there's a, you'll remember his name, I don't, there's some guy who was involved in driving, funding Brexit, who actually was saying, inferring that he hoped that Greta Thunberg's little boat that is currently going from Southampton to Washington, D.C., would capsize in the ocean, right? So let them vilify, sorry, what is his name? Correct, right? So don't feel afraid. History will certainly judge us harshly if we don't do what the children are asking us to do. Because the children know well that they are going to pay the price for the inaction of political and business leaders for more than three decades. And bear in mind, we've known about the threat of climate change since 1992 at the Earth Summit that took place in Rio. It's not a new story. But the fossil fuel companies have been contaminating the public debate, misinformation, and so on, which has held us back. However, civil disobedience is a very broad canvas. It includes many things. And I want to be clear that I, in advocating as strongly as I do, as does Amnesty, that peaceful civil disobedience is what we need desperately. At a time when there is so much of hate, so much of violence, so much of aggravation, activism must be imbued by love, compassion, caring, and a sense for justice and peace and dignity. And therefore, it's important that while I can understand fully the anger that I see, especially amongst young people, who can sometimes be manipulated into actions of violence and so on, I'm appealing to young people consistently. Don't give them an excuse to actually turn the message away from what you're doing. Because some of you might remember there was a Christian Aid was very actively involved in a protest in Birmingham against the G7 around debt about maybe close to 18 years ago. Anybody remembers the G8 protest in Birmingham where you folks made a line around the G8, 70,000 people? How many of you remember it? At least a few people remember. Most of the people don't remember, but you know why? It was completely peaceful. Not a single stone was thrown and so on, right? Sadly, the challenge there is to the media. It's not for us to become violent to get the attention. It's for the media to wake up and actually report in the ways that we need to. But let's be clear. Part of the problem we face right now is that too much of the communication channels are controlled by the very people that are driving us in the direction of inequality and so on. I mean, you go to Russia, there's virtually no media that is not controlled and influenced by the Putin regime, for example. And that can be told of many other countries around the world. So within the question of And let me just be very transparent with you. The question of civil disobedience is a sensitive matter, even for Amnesty. Right now, Amnesty is having a whole conversation about, as an organization that supports the respect for the rule of law in broad terms and so on, what does that mean if we break a law, etc., etc. Unjust laws certainly should be broken, right? Mandela had no hesitation in calling on us to break unjust laws. But laws that also prevent the voices of ordinary people from being heard as also need to be broken, because right now, in more than 100 countries around the world, in the last 5 years, governments have taken various actions to shrink the civic space by restricting freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and freedom of expression. So the options for activism are shrinking. And that's also dangerous, because if young people, for example, don't have a legal, above-ground public way of expressing themselves, we are forcing those energies and those frustrations and those resentments underground, and then the consequences of that are going to be much more devastating. Sometimes civil disobedience is called NVDA. Does anybody know what NVDA stands for? Okay, see, lots of people ready for civil disobedience here. So non-violent direct action was something that Martin Luther King and the community of activists that he worked with gave it to us. It was picked up by Greenpeace. And, you know, in Greenpeace, you, for example, have to be a, you have to go for an NVDA course before you do, you know, any action, because mainly we want to make sure that activists are trained so that when there's police provocation and so on, we don't respond with violence and we don't respond in the way that they that we might be attacked. So I want to just say something, though, about the rule of law before I end, and hopefully there'll be lots of questions. So how many of you think the rule of law, how many of you, if you ask, do you support the rule of law, how many of you will put your hands up to say, okay? Wait, keep your hands up. This is a very interesting answer. So it's about one third, you'd say, if my math is not too bad. Okay, put your hands up. How many of you don't support the notion of the rule of law? Please put up your hands. Huh? One brave man. Two. Okay. Three. And there's a brave young woman there. Okay. Can I put you on the spot? Would you like to come up quickly and tell me? Okay. So why? So basically, thank you, by the way. Sometimes it's the folks who are in the minority that provoke us to think in the most bold ways. So basically, as a labor historian in the US, Howard Zinn, put it some decades ago, he said the rule of law has become the darling of the powerful and the tyranny of the powerless. The people who can access rule of law are people who have to have certain level of education, certain level of money, certain level of access to legal representation. There are many people who by law have rights that they should be able to exercise, but are never able to exercise that law. Let me give you Amnesty International example on death penalty. On the death penalty, for example, if you look at who's been on death penalty in the past and who's under threat at the moment, almost inevitably, there are people who come from lower economic strata in society. Okay, so you can see in the way, to put it in a crude way, it seems rich people never make it to the death penalty. And quite frankly, you know as well as I do, rich people are not that well behaved compared to poor people, that they are not making it to death row, right? So basically, they control the system, and we have to address that inequality. So what I'm saying is, it's not saying throw out rule of the law in its entirety. Amnesty supports rule of law in broad terms, but what we're saying is we need to problematize it, we need to look at its deficiencies, and the three people who put up there, and I want to thank them, because they are challenging us not to just take certain things that sound nice without interrogating how it is practiced, right? There are lots of nice-sounding things that our government say, like, you know, your UK Parliament declared a climate emergency when Greta Thunberg and the kids put pressure on them. What does it mean? I'm not saying that it's not good that that climate emergency was declared, but has it changed any behavior? It's almost as if they ticked a box to say, well, okay, we got the pressure off us now, so we can continue as business as usual. So before I go to questions, I just want to end with a story. The story is a slightly sad story, but focus on the inspirational bit, not on the sad bit. So when I was 22 years old, I was fleeing South Africa into exile, And my best friend at that time, a guy called Lenny, asked me a question. He said, Kumi, what is the biggest contribution we can make to the cause of humanity? And I said, that's a very simple question, giving your life. And he said, you mean going, participating in a demonstration, getting shot and killed and becoming a martyr? Now, that was happening in South Africa every week at that time. Every other weekend, we were at funerals burying our friends who had been murdered by the regime. So I said, yes. And then he said to me, that's a wrong answer. He said, it's not giving your life, but giving the rest of your life. I was 22 years old that time. My friend Lenny was way ahead of us. He was the first environmentalist amongst us. I jokingly say at that time he probably like was one of only 5,000 voluntary vegetarians on the entire African continent. I mean, the guy was ahead of his time, right? So he would say these philosophical things. So, you know, we shrugged, hugged each other, shed some tears, and went our separate ways into exile. 2 years later, while I was a student at Oxford University, I get a call that my friend Lenny and three young women from my home city had been brutally murdered by the apartheid regime. There were so many bullets in their bodies, the parents couldn't even recognize them at the mortuary. Of course, I had to think deep and hard then about that distinction he made in that last conversation that I had with him, about giving your life versus giving the rest of your life. What he was saying is, the struggle for economic justice, social justice, climate justice, gender justice, indigenous people's rights, and so on. These struggles are marathons, they're not sprints. And the best that any one of us can do, like the people in this pagoda tent today, who've had the privilege of education and understanding the injustice in our world, is staying true to those struggles with perseverance, with stamina, with fortitude, and continue to push and push and push until those struggles are won. Nelson Mandela used to say, it always feels impossible until it is done. And I want to pay tribute, in conclusion, to the faith community in general and Christian Aid as an organization, which I had the benefit when I fled into exile in 1987, who supported me when I arrived here, who supported my work in South Africa before I fled here. And when I look around this hall and I look at the diversity of people based on age, especially, I want to say that I see many people in this room who took my friend Lenny's advice, that you have, I'm guessing that some of you have been involved in your activism for a long period of time, and you still remain engaged. So in conclusion, I want to say that we have a simple choice right now. We can be depressed, we can say we're running out of time, and we can say perhaps activism and resistance to injustice is not worth it. But I want to believe that we will listen to our children, to their cries, to their appeals, for us to show moral courage, and that when we look back 10 years from now, it is my hope that through the peaceful resistance to the pathway that we're on, which is a suicidal trajectory that our leaders are taking us, that the resistance from children, older people, people of all ages, people of all classes, and so on, and I believe we are on the brink of building that unity, because today you don't need to be a climate scientist to know that our world is in this. You just had to be in England on the 24th of April when it was 39 degrees, for example. And many other parts of the world, I can quote you one record after the other being broken. So I just want to end with the Mahatma Gandhi quotation, because the reality is, you know, from what you hear from happening around the world, I mean, if you just take Amnesty as an example, our office in London has been raided in the last 6 months. Our bank accounts have been frozen. In Nigeria, the army has been in our office. In Turkey, our chair has been in prison for 14 months. Our executive director in prison for 10 months. You know, so basically, we are taking major, major repression, not just Amnesty, all of civil society. And one of the things that I'm very happy to say is that we can respond to that hate with love and with humor. We don't have to respond with hate. So, for example, my friends in the Turkish prison, when I saw them, they were. I said, "How did you cope with the 14 months and bad conditions?" And said, they said, "Just like how you guys in South Africa cope. We laugh. We say to the oppressor, you can do what you will. We'll never stop smiling. We'll never stop having fun. We'll make sure that the very act of resistance is one where we enjoy each other, where we build friendships and so on." So one of the jokes they told me was a prisoner goes to the librarian in a Turkish prison and says, "Please, can I have this book by this author?" And the prison librarian says, "Let me go check and come back." He goes, checks, come back. He says to the prisoner, "I got good news and I got bad news. Bad news is we don't have the book. Good news is we have the prisoner. Oh, we have the author." Right? So, but to end with the Gandhi, what Gandhi says, so I'm telling you about this, I'm ending on repression that we are facing now, not to depress you, not to demotivate you, because as, well, there's debate now whether Gandhi said this or a trade union leader said this in the early 20th century, but irrespective, it still is good. When they said, first, they ignore you. Then, they laugh at you. Then, they fight you. And then, you win. The good news is, they're not ignoring us. They're not laughing at us. They're fighting us. So, let's hope if Gandhi or the trade union leader or both of them were correct, that we are one step away from winning justice, dignity, and human rights for everybody on this planet. Thank you very, very much.
Well, Greenbelt, I feel that this evening we have been in the presence of greatness. Thank you so much. As before, we're going to do questions, and Kumi has indicated he's very keen to have a conversation with you, so do please think what you would like to ask him or comment or join in the conversation with him. As before, we have Lucy at that end with the microphone, and we have Joe at this end with the microphone. If you're not a young gazelle able to leap up into and to run to them, then put your hand up and we will come to you. So can I see one or two questioners, please? Do you want to go to Lucy? If you could go to the microphones, that'd be great. So I think this gentleman here first. Yeah.
All right. I put my hand up for the rule of law. Not that I want to defy the law, but there are so many laws that are wrong. And when we stop that, that's the problem. That's the problem we have now. There are not enough people saying that's wrong. Poll tax. You can go through and name hundreds of laws. Around the country, South Africa, huge challenges. It's everywhere in the world, and we need to challenge that. We're a civilized country. So challenge. I do it at work. Why are we doing that? And ask the question that parents don't like of their kids. Why, Daddy? Why? We need to answer those questions.
Thank you. I fully agree with you. I you know, there's nothing more to say that is the question we have to answer. And I feel that parents, because what the children are saying to us in the climate strike movement, they're saying, you parents of ours, don't let the people of power get away with murder. Don't let the people get away with taking away our future. And why is it, even though we love our children and grandchildren as much as we do, irrespective of race, color, country, continent, this cuts across. We all love our children and care about our children and their children, but still we're not able to muster. Let's hope that what will happen on the 20th of September, I hope many of you will start spreading the word about the and take action yourself on the 20th of September. Let's hope after that we will see a different momentum with the movement. And you know, like the kids' slogans and all are very simple and very evocative. When we were marching past Downing Street, when the kids were marching, I joined them on one occasion, and two young girls picked up a sign saying, "You can get better cabinets at IKEA."
I've been working with the youth strikers for a while now in the UK, and I actually just wanted to give people a website to go to for the 20th of September, because I reckon people are really up for it here. And it's www.uksn.org, and that's where you can find your nearest strike. We've had about 100 strikes registered so far across the UK, and we're aiming for about 250 by the 20th, with massive ones planned in all major cities. So I'm pretty sure wherever you are, there'll be one near you. And I can't emphasize enough what a big deal it is. I'm so glad you've plugged them so much. It builds me up, because this is the first time they've asked for adults to come with them and come out on the street with them. And I think it's really important that we don't let them down, because they've been leading, and we need to now show them how much their work means to us by getting on the street. So yeah, I just wanted to give a website where you can find your nearest strike. Sorry, it's www.uksn.org, which is the UK Student Climate Network, who are coordinating the strikes.
Thanks very much. Can I just remind people to keep their questions nice and short and their comments nice and short, so as many people as possible can speak? Can we take another one from your end, please, Lucy?
Why don't you call it three at a time so we can get more people?
So let's collect three questions at a time so more people get a chance. Please.
Okay. My question is, how would you describe your own spirituality that sustains you in your struggle for justice, or your worldview?
You've identified the need for perseverance, and I wonder what you'd say to the risk of martyrdom culture that exists in NGOs, specifically Amnesty. Thank you.
So say the first part of it.
The risk of martyrdom culture in NGOs. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Please.
One of the ways we can put pressure on our politicians is by who we vote for at an election. It's conceivable that we will have an election fairly soon. Which party would you vote for that approximates closely to meet the goals you prioritise?
Thank you. Can I take those three quickly? So let me take the last one, because I'm afraid I have to dodge that question. So let me just say that, quite frankly, in many countries today, when people are going to vote, they are not going to vote for the best party. They're going to vote for the least worst party or the least worst option. That's the reality. So one of the things that we have to be talking about right now is whether we need a recalibration, which is happening, but in a very awful way, because it's more the forces of hate and the forces of fascism, really, are the ones that are actually breaking the current political party configuration in Europe. For example, when we look in several countries in Europe, the Social Democrats have largely collapsed. The mainstream conservatives have dropped power, with far-right conservative movements emerging and so on. So I think the question for us is to recognize that in far too many countries, the electoral systems are broken. They have been captured themselves. I mean, listen, the US election is ridiculous, right? I mean, the US is got the form of democracy without the substance of democracy. There are three types of people that can run successfully for national political office in the United States: the rich, the extremely rich, and the obscenely rich, right? No, I mean, the political process is shut off from ordinary people, right? So even when people want to participate, I mean, I think the situation in Europe is much more accessible. I think if people get organized, yeah, with alternative visions of how politics could be organized, you have a greater chance, because money does not contaminate your politics as much as it does the politics in the United States. I'm not saying y'all are anywhere close to perfect, because let's face it, y'all have a minority government all the time. What I mean by that, if you go and look at how many people voted for the Conservative Party in the last three elections from David Cameron's last victory, It's nowhere more than 33% of the people of the voters actually voted because of the first past the vote system. And what about the people who are just disillusioned and who've taken a view, which I think it's unfortunate view, but far too many people have taken a view if voting changed anything, they would ban it, right? We have to get people to recognize, broken as our electoral systems are, we need to use it to the best of our ability and reform it and make it work, but recognizing upfront that it's imperfect. On the question of martyrdom, so I think the international NGO movements, all of whom were created in the developed parts of the world, carry the cultures from those parts of the world, right? And today we have a big challenge of how do we transform international NGOs to actually be truly global. We cannot simply say that because you tack the name international after Amnesty or Greenpeace or Oxfam or whatever, that makes them international. And I should also say, you don't deal with the problems of diversity and power by plonking somebody from Africa or Asia at the top and thinking you've dealt with diversity. So our organizations have a lot of work to do. And there's an article going around which talks about how, in fact, the international NGO movement has not addressed the question of diversity in their own countries and so on. And then, that's a more general point, but on the question of martyrdom, I wouldn't even use the word martyrdom because actually, to be blunt with you, I don't see that such a high level of moral courage within the international NGO movement compared to Extinction Rebellion, the Fridays for the Future struggles and so on. I actually think that the international NGO movement needs to up its game and to take more risks because they have more capability, more resources and so on. When smaller organizations in the Amazon right now, indigenous peoples and so on, are putting their entire lives at risk, we need to do much more. On spirituality, I got asked the question earlier. So this is a very personal answer to the question. So when I was about 12 years old, my teacher at school, who was my favorite teacher, said to me, basically he had converted to Christianity from Hinduism, and he was like sort of saying, you know, Christianity was the best religion and all. And because he was my best teacher, you know, my favorite teacher, I went home and I, in a very tortured way, asked my mom, you know, my teacher says this and so on. And I was being brought up as a Hindu. And my mom said to me, you know, all religions are the same, fundamentally. And the only thing you need to worry about religion is see God in the eyes of every human being you meet. Look for the strengths in them and look for the weaknesses in yourself, because you might be able to do something about the weaknesses in yourself. You're never going to be able to do much about the weaknesses in others. So for me, my spirituality is about how we treat each other and how we treat all living things. And I cannot accept that somebody claims to be deeply religious and can walk past homeless people, can see a forest burning and say that, you know, if you think about it, and I wanted to say this, I've said it to religious leaders many times over the last 10 years. Our religious leaders failed us for far too long by not recognizing that if you believe that God created planet Earth and all that is on it, he didn't only create us, but also if you believe in all the religions, you read the text, you know, God is supposed to have created our mountains, our oceans, our rivers, our forests, and so on. But when all of these were being decimated, far too many of our religious leaders, their silence was deafening, and we need to change that.
Three more, please.
Yeah, I'd like to make an observation and see what you think of it. You touched on it just a little while ago when you mentioned martyrdom. The price of civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action isn't uniform all over the world. In Boris Johnson's Britain, if you engage in civil disobedience, you might get fined, you might lose your job, you might get expelled from school, You might, if you're really unlucky, get in prison for a short time. Nelson Mandela was in prison for the greater part of his life. Martin Luther King in the US was assassinated. Mahatma Gandhi in India was assassinated. In Nazi Germany, Sophie Scholl and the White Rose Movement were all guillotined. A few months ago, I was in Chile, visited the Human Rights Memorial and Museum dedicated to the victims of the Pinochet regime, saw the exhibits showing graphically what happened to people who non-violently resisted that dictatorship. Yes, let's have non-violent resistance all over the world, but not everybody is going to pay the same price.
Yeah, I'm immensely proud of my 16-year-old. In our city, he set up the our climate strikes. I've spent 16 years training him to be obedient. I am now perfectly happy to encourage him to be civilly disobedient. But this is very selfish. I'm a mother. I want him out of jail. I want him alive. So what can I do as a parent to help encourage? I mean, he is amazing and I want him to do amazing things, but I want him to be safe.
Hi. So you touched on the problem, a massive problem that the media doesn't seem to want to report on reasonable, peaceful protests. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that activists, at least in Britain, face in terms of people feel really disheartened by it. And it makes the whole situation seem hopeless. I think it's often seen as a kind of perennial, intractable problem. But do you think there's space in organisations like AI or Greenpeace for kind of directly challenging the media and trying to hold them to account to report on human rights issues and environmental issues? Yeah.
Thank you for mentioning the young people and all that. I mean, I can't claim responsibility for much of it at all, but I just wanted to say that those that are marching on the streets are very much the minority, and what I see from the majority of those, at least those that are aware, is just a complete despondence. A lot of my peers have just completely given up. They see the warnings of 12, 11 years, and they say, well, there's no point doing anything. What can I tell them?
Thank you. Thank you for all those excellent comments and questions. Thank you very much for your comment, because what his comment very strongly portrays is what I should have said in my comments, that civil disobedience, for it to be successful, has to be deeply contextual, right? What is a good civil society action? A civil disobedience action in one place, in terms of risk, in terms of effectiveness, and so on, could be a complete disaster in another. Let me give you an example. Maybe in New York, a civil disobedience action, I've seen it happen a couple of times, where there are some politicians talking nonsense. I'm a bit anxious about saying the next word, but I'll take a chance that you folks are okay with it. Do you know this word, mooning? Okay, you know mooning, right? Okay, so you know mooning, sorry, I see some people don't know, you know, four people pulling the pants and showing the backside, right? With maybe some words written on the cheeks of the bum. Now, that might work well in New York. It's not going to work well in Saudi Arabia. Okay? So, at two levels, both in terms of what it communicates to the public and how it moves the public, but your point, which is the differentiated level of risk associated in different places. So, we have to take that into account. But the irony, my brother, is some of the highest levels of courage that we are seeing is, in fact, in the most repressive places, ironically. If you take the Arab, so-called Arab Spring, right? By the way, my friends in the Arab world always are saying, please don't call it Arab Spring. Just call it the Arab resistance to authoritarian dictatorship, because they say that the struggle for justice is not a seasonal activity. You know, spring, and so basically, I mean, they took on some of the most unmovable regimes that we thought there were. Mubarak in Egypt and so on were fully supported, sadly, by the United States, Britain, and other powerful Western governments for years, right? That's a fact. Whatever they can say, go look at the military transfers of equipment. That will tell, tell you the story. So I think that, and even now, the two most inspiring examples recently, Ethiopia and Sudan. In Sudan, it was women and young women in large numbers that went and occupied the army barracks and said, we're not leaving until this guy goes. Nobody thought that Bashar will ever go. He's gone. It's been tough. But thankfully, there is now the possibility that Sudan, over the last 4 days, what has happened, that we've got an interim government. And if the military plays by the rules, we might see the possibility of Sudan building a democratic future and a just future. So I think this is a really important point, and I want to connect yours to my sister, the last question, which I really love that. I'll come back to you. The lady who was worried about her son. Yeah. So, you know, I want to say how grateful I am that you said it, right? Because let me just say that none of us who are parents, none of us, even if we're not parents, if we just have friends who have kids, we don't want to risk our kids' lives. I mean, that's what I grew up in apartheid South Africa, right? You know, like I got involved at the age of 15. And, you know, we didn't understand much. In fact, I jokingly always remind people in my first march, the slogan at the front of the march was, we want equality. By the time the slogan got to the younger kids at the back of the march, the younger kids were chanting, we want a color TV. Because kids in white schools had color TVs, kids in black schools had no TVs. And if I'm brutally honest with you, at that time I wanted a color TV and equality almost equally. Right? So I think that the one thing that I would, based on how I responded as a young person when elders were trying to say, be careful, you're going to end up on Robben Island prison with Mandela and so on. My advice to you is make sure that he's getting all the support to be taking the sensible, calculated risks on anything that he's doing. Make sure he's informed. Make sure if he's going to escalate his activism at some point, make sure that he understands the law. And you have to make sure that anybody who takes risk is taking informed risk, whether they're 16 years old or whether they're 60 years old. So I'll give you an example. When I occupied the oil rig in Russia with six of my colleagues, the six of us that were going to go and occupy the Russian Gazprom oil rig in 2012, about three times in the 10 days while we're sailing to get to that point, the person coordinating the action every couple of days gets the team together and says, folks, there's no harm in saying that you're scared. Because he told us that we were facing 6 years in prison in Russia and so on, worst case scenario, right? But the problem is peer pressure, right? Because peer pressure could mean that your son might be in a situation where he might feel a bit scared, but if everybody else wants to do it, he gets pushed. And I saw that with a young man who was there with us amongst the six. I saw something in his eye. I called a suspension of the meeting. I pulled him aside. I said, hey, are you sure you're okay? He said, hey, Kumi, you know what? I'm absolutely fine about taking the risk. I'll go to prison for 20 years if necessary because I'm committed. But I just can't stand what it will do to my mother. Right? And then we got the satellite phone from the captain. I said, you have to talk to your mother. You have to make peace with her. Because if we're going to spend 6 months, even 6 months in prison, and I probably would have been, in the same cell with him, the worst thing to have is somebody who has unresolved family guilt who then finds themselves. So I'm giving you the worst case scenario. Sorry, I moved it too far. But... But your son sounds amazing, right? Encourage him, which you're doing and you feel proud for him. But, there are even books on nonviolent direct action that you can find which tells you how to, deal with police and so on. So just to finish quickly on the young lady. So thank you. That is such an honest... Because she had an option, by the way, yeah? She had an option to just stand up there and say, I'm part of that movement, I've done my little, and we're doing great. But what she's done is taken an advice that good leaders give, which is tell no lies and claim no easy victories. Those are the words of Amilcar Cabral, an anti-colonial leader in the small country of Guinea-Bissau in West Africa. And so what you've said is, yes, we're doing well. We are getting more and more people involved, but the majority are still not with us. And let's be honest, the majority are not with us. And we have lots more work to do that. And part of it, I think for young people, and my experience of youth work, you know, is you've got to firstly understand that young people have a right to have fun, right? Young people have a right to be playing sport, developing their cultural, you know, whether it's music. And for us to take away that right, like people like myself, it was taken away because struggle completely is wrong, right? So part of what we have to do is create movements for young people that also celebrate the experience of being young. It should be fun. And, you know, as some people say, we should not rule out the possibility of believing that activism is also can be quite sexy. So let me end with, I think, the most important question that was asked about the media environment. So let me end with this point. So most of us believe that our governments and big powerful corporations control us by the deployment of what you could call the repressive state apparatus, army, police, formal laws, rules and regulations, and so on. And it's true that the repressive state apparatus does constrain a lot what you can do or you cannot do. However, the more insidious and more powerful form of control is what you could call the ideological state apparatus. That is the framework for education and schooling, the framework for religion, norms and social norms and customs, and critically important, the framework for the media. Right? So today, let me do a quick experiment as I conclude. How many of you here have watched CNN International? Keep your hands up. How many of you have watched CNN International? Keep your hands up. Okay, keep it up, right? Of those of you who've got your hands up and have watched CNN International, how many of you think that CNN International is a left-wing, radical, or revolutionary news source? Okay, nobody. Nobody, okay. So, but see what happens in the United States. In the United States, people don't even see the CNN International that we see. They see a conservative version known as CNN or CNN Headline News. However, this conservative version of CNN International within the political continuum of the media in the US is on the far left. Right? So, I have a lot of sympathy with the American people in the sense of they, like white South Africans, were misled into a false belief that that system of apartheid was viable and defendable, are actually unaware of what is really happening in the society. So let me just say that we have, if we are going to succeed, part of our struggle has to be to fight for a diverse media that ensures that all perspectives, I don't have any problem with right-wing perspectives and all having a fair, you know, say. But it's when that is the main perspective that we have a problem. And I leave you with this thought, and I know some of you might not like it. The challenge before us, while we think about our courage to engage in civil disobedience and more robust resistance, we have to balance that with having the capability to muster real love, real understanding, and real compassion for the people that voted for Brexit, for the people that voted for Trump, the people that voted for Orban in Hungary, unless we understand why they were shifted in that direction, so and understand the insecurities that took them there, we need to find the way to help them to come back to decency. And the only way we can do that if we recognize the humanity. And the struggle for justice is not about standing up and proclaiming how great and politically perfect we are. The real activism is not just about talking with people that agree with you. Real activism is about humbling yourself and going and talking to people who disagree with you with respect, with humanity and so on, so that can win them to what you believe in, if you genuinely believe that the cause that you are fighting for is just, you shouldn't feel afraid to go into any forum, make your case, and stand a chance of shifting people, not immediately, but even if you shift people slightly in your direction after one conversation, that shift is worth the effort, provided they are moving towards human rights, equality, respect, and fundamentally respecting the rights of our children to be able to live on this planet for centuries and centuries to come. Thank you very, very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.